Hello, everybody, and welcome to the premiere episode of Hail to the Keith, a history-based podcast here on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. I am your host, Keith E. Langston, and I am very excited today to talk, to debut this new podcast where I'm going to try to give you a condensed version of, years, decades, centuries, maybe even, into, an hour and a half, depending on how long I can keep talking here, for topics of various topics throughout history, and really so that you have an opportunity to maybe share some of these while you're at a dinner party or a family event or a work function, or even just sitting at your desk waiting for a phone call to come in and you're talking to your coworker, or you're even sitting there telling your sibling or your spouse or significant other or whoever, just something to break the ice. I really hope that you like this. I really would appreciate some feedback because I'm going to try to do this solo. I don't know how well I'm going to do, but hopefully I can hit this out of the park and we'll be able to have something new here on the network that you can, another topic of discussion or another area of interest for people. And the seems to be that people seem to be interested in history kind of from a point of view, a very lay person's point of view. They don't need to know all the details. You don't need to know all the dates and all the specifics. And I can certainly give you those if you want, but that's going to be kind of an off-site thing, you know, offline, so to speak. So I hope you enjoy this, and I'm looking forward to bringing this to you every once in a while. I don't know how frequently I'll get this out, but it is going to be something that I think once I start getting into it and kind of hone this and make this real tight and concise and nice and crisp, it'll be something that you can enjoy as well. So for the first topic I want to talk about this week, it kind of stems from a conversation I was having on a previous A La Carte with Keithy, and my guest was Shiffy Schiff, and we were talking about, oddly enough, the DCEU, so the DC Extended Universe, and we were talking about the Wonder Woman movie, and I was saying how I love when movies that are going to be talking about the World Wars kind of go back to World War I instead of World War II. I feel like with just Indiana Jones alone, we've had our fair share of people fighting the Nazis and whatnot. So it's always interesting to me when somebody goes back to the pre-Nazi era of Germany, so the real German Empire era of the early 1900s. And that is exactly what World War One. That was exactly what Wonder Woman did in that movie. She basically fights in World War One in the European theater. And the thing I had mentioned is that I find that from listening to really Dan Carlin's Hardcore History and his, I think it was 6 or 7 epic podcast on World War One. It was one of those things where it just brought out so many amazing pieces of just unique history, and where we really didn't know, I didn't know as much as I think I should have, and I was really kind of embarrassed at the fact that I didn't know enough about World War One, because you know it's a very amazing piece of history. I don't know if you can actually find any of that, like behind, I think a lot of what Dan Carlin's Hardcore History is now behind like a paywall, but if you can go back, maybe you could still get it on, you know, Apple Podcast or any other kind of podcast or podcatcher app. Try to check it out. It was Blueprint for Armageddon. That was his five issues. It was a 5-issue series on World War One. Each one of them, though, was like 6 hours long. So, I mean, it was a significant period of amount of time that it took to listen to it, but well worth it. I mean, the guy goes into great detail about the Eastern, about the Western Front. He talks a little bit about the Eastern Front. And it just goes into so much, really. And one of the things that I really enjoyed was he kind of starts back to the downfall of Napoleon in 1815, and it's really weird to think that the buildup of World War One was kind of 100 years in the making almost. When I was in junior high school, my 8th grade teacher, his name was Mr. Bavaro. Coincidentally, he is the father of New York Giant great Mark Bavaro, so we used to hear about that as well and always question him about the Giant Super Bowls and, you know, the big tuna and all that kind of stuff. And but needless to say, when he was talking about World War One, he would bring up the powder keg effect, and it was something that he went into great detail and just kind of, you know, not really knowing what that was and what did that mean, that kind of thing. And it was what the powder keg was. It was all of these little aggressions, not microaggressions. That's a 21st century term, but these kind of aggressions that had been really taking place since the Congress of Vienna, which took place in 1814, 1815. And that was at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, where Europe basically got together and they said, okay, this is what we're going to do with the mainland of the continent of Europe. And they started to carve out pieces of land, and they started to set up international borders. And it was really one of the ways where they said, okay, we're going to make sure that we keep the balance of power this way. And it was really a long term, or at least the objection of it was to kind of have a long term peace for Europe. It lasted 100 years. I think that that's pretty significant, if you ask me. I'm trying to think of any peace treaty that's lasted that long. Maybe the original Treaty of Paris between the U.S. and no, not even, because that was 1812. That war happened. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty good to see that there's been a lot of peace. There was peace for at least a period of time. However, there were also a lot of issues that came up. Like I said, there were aggressions that took place during that period of time, during that 100 years or 99 years. There were certain things. The Ottoman Empire, which was which kind of takes place in present-day Turkey. The Ottoman Empire, which stemmed from the Byzantine Empire, if you ever think of Byzantine Empire, that sounds kind of familiar. What is that again? The Byzantine Empire was really the Eastern Roman Empire. So you heard that correctly. The Eastern Roman Empire. The Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire, that's the Octavius, that's Nero, that's Caligula. That's what we're talking about, is the Roman Empire. And when the Roman Empire started to really kind of dissolve itself, it split into the two factions of the Western and the Eastern. And that was once the fall of the Western Empire, the Byzantine Empire rose to power and 3 something AD, like 383, 333, something like that AD. It lasted all the way up until like the 1400s. And then in the 1400s, after the fall of Constantinople, which Istanbul was Constantinople, the Ottoman Empire kind of took over. And that was a unification of the Turks and the Ottomans under the ruler of Osman the First, and he was the founder of the Ottoman Empire. And that was, like I said, it took place around the 1400s, and that was where we get the Ottoman state. And that holds true for almost 500 years, you know, all the way up until like 1914. The end of the war, really, it kind of split, but from the beginning part of it, it was really one of these that there were starting to become a lot of different states in the Balkan areas were starting to declare their independence. States like Serbia and Yugoslavia and just different Balkan states like Greece had kind of declared its independence once again. And so there was just all these little states in that Balkan area of the Mediterranean that started to declare their independence. But there was kind of this weird, almost border support issue almost between the Austrian-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. But there were still these little states that were coming up, and they were not really happy with either of the major countries coming in. But a little bit on that a little bit later. Another thing that I want to kind of throw into the powder keg, if you will, adding fuel to the fire, you know, pun intended, is the imperialism that started to spread across Africa. Now, at the time, Africa was starting, they were starting to really, or they had been colonizing Africa. And I mean, we're talking like the entirety of the continent of Africa is getting carved up between these European nations. And it's not just England and France, it was also Portugal, Spain, Belgium, Germany. I mean, these were countries were going in, they were planting their flag, and they were starting to access the resources and continue on with the colonization of Africa. And of course, that had been bumping up against each other. You could say that was really a cause because of the Monroe Doctrine, which was something put forth from James Monroe, President of the United States, where he declared in the 1800s, he said, no more colonialism in North or South America. So they really had nowhere to go. So they started to look for somewhere else. They looked for Africa. And so you have these countries in Europe starting to make their claims, their colonial claims. And of course, there's going to be some bumping heads and bump and grind and things like that with each other. So you had that. You had the decline of the Ottoman Empire that was going into this powder keg. You also had these alliances that were set up. And I mean, we're talking about alliances that were set up for decades prior to, because you had certain things after the Vienna Convention of Vienna, where you had other countries starting to take shape. Prussia, for instance, Prussia, which was the Kingdom of Prussia, which ended up becoming Germany, was starting to come together and became its own country due to wars it had with Austria. And there was wars with the Ottomans and Russia. And so you started to see a lot of these different countries come with alliances. Italy became unified and they started to seek out, you know, alliances and things of that nature. So you had a lot of just movement around in Europe where people were just, these countries are starting to align with each other. You end up coming up with two major alliances. You have the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente. And the Triple Alliance was essentially Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Italy. And the Triple Entente was France, Russia, and the United Kingdom. And these were kind of like the six major powers in Europe at the time. The Ottomans kind of snuck in afterwards, after the fact, and really supported the Triple Alliance. But besides that, prior to the war, this is where we were coming in. It seemed like there was a lot of animosity and a lot of irritations and aggravations in the Austria-Hungarian Empire prior to that. Like I said, they had started to kind of insert their dominance maybe in the Balkan area, and it was met with some resistance. With all of these issues coming to a head in June of 1914, June 28th to be exact, is where we come to the spark that lights the powder keg for World War One and the Great War, or the Grand War, or whatever you want to call it. And of course, we're talking about the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And not the band, but the actual Archduke. Ba-dum-bum-bum. Anyway, now, Franz Ferdinand of Austria, he is the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. Him and his wife were assassinated on June 28, 1914, by a Bosnian Serb, Gavrilo Princip. Now, the story behind this is, again, something that a lot of people don't hear of because it's kind of glossed over, because it really just ends with Princip fatally wounding the royal couple and having the war kind of kick off. But the Archduke and his wife were in Sarajevo, and they were on their way to the Sarajevo town hall. There was a motorcade. It was a six-car motorcade that was heading towards the town hall. Princip and five other conspirators had lined the route. Their idea behind it was that they were going to assassinate and try to eliminate the Archduke and then cause for the freedom of Bosnia. But, or the freedom of Serbia, excuse me. But the problem was this. There was the first conspirator. His name was Mehmed Basik, excuse me. And he lost his nerve and he allowed the car to pass without taking any action. At 10:15, when the motorcade passed the central police station, a 19-year-old student, Nedeljko Kaprinovic, hurled a hand grenade at the Archduke's car. Now, the driver saw this and accelerated, and the bomb had a 10-second delay and exploded under the fourth car, which two of the occupants were seriously wounded. After the failed attempt, the motorcade sped away, and Princip and the remaining conspirators failed to act because the cars were speeding away. Now, the Archduke gave a scheduled speech, and he decided to go to the victims of the grenade attack at the Sarajevo hospital. Now, to avoid kind of like the city center or whatever, they decide that they're going to drive around in a different way because they don't want to obviously lead to anything happening. Long story short, the generals for the Archduke forgot to tell the driver that they were going to do this. They were going to make a change in the road. And so he's going the original plan. He's going the original way. He turns onto a side street where Princip was actually at a delicatessen. He was at a restaurant and probably sitting having a drink going, Jesus, what did I do? I messed everything up. Then the cars stop. The driver's getting yelled at saying, what are you doing, man? We're in the wrong place. He starts to reverse the car to go back. The engine stalls and the gears lock. Now, Franz Ferdinand and his wife are literally in front of Gavrilo Princip. And he's like, this is my lucky day. So he stands up, he draws a pistol, and at point blank range, he fires twice into the car. First, he hits the Archduke in the neck, and then he hits his wife in the abdomen. They both die shortly after that. And that's the assassination of the Archduke, the heir to the throne. Now, the Austro-Hungarian government, who already had seen Serbia's nationalist threats to their own empire, they used this assassination as a pretext to take action against Serbia. And now the events all triggered are called the July Crisis, which leads to the outbreak of World War I. And the July Crisis is, I find funny that the July Crisis is starts on June 28th, but that's okay. but it was, like I said, it was started because the Austro-Hungarian government decided to blame Serbia and the Serbian nationalists for the murder of their heir apparent. And with that, it starts to lead to all of this tensions kind of mounting. And the reason being is because all of these alliances that had been in place for a while start to come together. Now, if you kind of think of the current day alliance of NATO, and people talk about that a lot, especially with the crisis going on right now in the Ukraine and Ukraine wanting to join NATO. And it's, you know, what does that all mean? Well, essentially, when you have an alliance, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. So if you have, you know, if Ukraine entered into NATO and the Russian government decided to attack Ukraine, all of a sudden now you have all the other countries in NATO are going to have to come to their aid. And that could cause a big problem. So at this point in time, Serbia has an alliance with Russia, who also has an alliance with Great Britain, who also has an alliance with France. Well, Austria-Hungary has an alliance with Germany as well as Italy. And again, entering in 1914, the Ottoman Empire. So what do we do? Well, this is where we start getting into problems. Hungary, they declare war against Serbia. Russia has to come to their aid, and we're off to the races. And really what happened is there were some different peace treaty. There were some different meetings. They couldn't keep the peace. This was something that I think most countries were ready for. You know, they were ready for this to happen. I think a lot of people felt that the World War I was not an issue of if, it was going to be when. And I think that a lot of the countries that were starting to gain power in that period of time said, okay, this is what's going to happen. One last thing I do want to mention, though, before we move on from Gavrilo Princip, is an actual quote that he has where, you know, it was during his trial, and he said, I am a Yugoslav nationalist aiming for the unification of all Yugoslavs, and I do not care what form of state, but it must be free from Austria. The plan was to unite all South Slavs. It was understood that Serbia, as the free part of the South Slavs, had a moral duty to help in the unification, to be to the South Slavs as the Piedmont was to Italy. In my opinion, every Serb, Croat, and Slovene should be an enemy of Austria. Later on in his life, towards his end, Princip was tried and convicted and sentenced to 20 years. Not death, but 20 years, which is kind of interesting. He was chained to a wall in solitary confinement. He developed tuberculosis. He died 3 years and 10 months after the assassination. But he had been visited by a psychiatrist in the Austro-Hungarian army. And the psychiatrist actually wrote that Princip asserted that the First World War would have occurred even if the assassination had not taken place, and that he cannot feel himself responsible for that catastrophe. So that's something that doesn't get talked about a lot, is that regardless of whether or not he committed that assassination, like I said, the war was probably going to take place anyway. It had been something that had been, you know, I had mentioned before the 99 years of peace that they had after the Napoleonic Wars, but this was coming to be an issue. It was, there was too much bumping and grinding, so to speak, for them to avoid this for long. So you have on, with that, you have on July 28th, 1914, Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia. Serbia then, and this is the start of what's called the Great War, the First World War, or just the Great War. They really started calling it, obviously, after they had multiple. But originally, Austria-Hungary didn't think that it was going to be this major of a conflict. They figured it was going to be a war between just two countries. However, because we had already had such this powder keg set up for a massive conflict to take place, as soon as that declaration of war happens, all the dominoes fall. You have Russia declares war on the Austria-Hungarian Empire. Because Germany is their ally, they declare war against Russia. Now, Germany itself was well prepared for going to war militarily. They had such a huge bank of weaponry and they would have been great, because if the war started, there was actually on July 3rd, one of the, or July 2nd rather, one of the ambassadors wrote to King Wilhelm II saying to him that he wanted Austria and Hungary to attack Serbia as quickly as possible because the time was right for the war, since Germany was way more prepared than either Russia or France. And their original plan, their war plan, so to speak, was as soon as they declared war on Russia, they were going right after France. And that was the only thing they could think of, was invading Belgium and France, because they wanted to capture as much, they wanted to claim land. So it's, like I said, the pieces continue to fall. You have, as soon as Germany declares war on Russia, France declares war on Germany, and then it starts to become an issue with the mainland of Europe. Before we get into some of the battles, there are some things that I do want to bring up, and that has to do with Britain trying to mediate peace and keep things going before it actually happened. That obviously didn't pan out as well as it should have. And when you start to have mobilizations of troops, then it's really just, this is it. This is where we're at. And then finally, by August 4th, Britain declares war against Germany, and in a odd retaliation back, Austria-Hungary declares war on Russia on August 6th. So by August 6th, we're at war, okay? Now, World War One, I want to talk about, there's a couple of different theaters of war that took place. There's the Eastern Front and the Western Front. The Western Front is really the one that a lot of people talk about. That's the ones that take place mostly on the mainland, France, Belgium, Germany. You'll hear a lot of different battles of the Battle of the Marne, and that's the trench warfare that you see a lot of, and just battles, Battle of Verdun, things like that, Battle of the Somme. Those are all the kind of the major battles that took place where there was just this amazing battle of military from Germany and France and Belgium, and you ended up, that's where the British enter, and then that's where the United States start to come into play, and it's really on the Western Front. You can't, however, forget about the other areas of war, the other theaters, like the Eastern Front, which took place mostly between Russia and Romania, and the Austrian, Hungarian, Bulgaria, Ottoman Empire, Germany on the other side. That ranged really from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south, and involved most of Eastern Europe, even into Central Europe. And it's another area where it's kind of forgotten that, you know, that was another major front. And that's really because it's not as sexy as the Western Front. I don't know. For lack of a better word, I feel like it's just one of these things where, you know, war's not pretty. And I think that there's a lot more romanticism with the stories that came from the Western Front, I feel like, for World War One and even World War Two as well. If you look at World War II, the battles between the Germans and the Russians is just, or the Soviets even at that point, it's awful. It's some of the most depressing and just gory and just hideous kinds of things that you see in that. And a lot too with even the Asian and Pacific theater and for World War II. But, you know, that's getting ahead of us, and we're talking about World War I. But we also had some other major engagements. We had people may have heard of Gallipoli, and Gallipoli was a campaign that took place during First World War. Actually, the architect of the Gallipoli campaign for the United Kingdom was Winston Churchill, and that was not a success for the Triple Entente. That was actually an Ottoman victory, and that takes place in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, but around Turkey in that area. You also had some battles in Mesopotamia. You had some battles in Southwest Africa, Cameroon, East Africa, North Africa. You also had Samoa, New Guinea, other places in Central Asia. There was a theater of war in Central Asia where you had anti-Russian uprising that was kind of in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. So there was various theaters of war that took place, and it really kind of encompasses that. It's, even though they called it a world war, really because of the allies and that were involved, and then you kind of have the United States joining the fray, it really is a war that encompasses most of Europe, Africa, and Asia. And that's something that you have to kind of pull back and look at it, you know, look at a map and say, damn, this really was like a massive, massive global confrontation. It wasn't just war between two countries or a war between three or four countries. It was a war. It was a world war. It really was. And it was kind of the first of its kind, really, where just so many different arms of the war reached out and took place and transformed this world from, you know, I like to say like a 19th century kind of Napoleonic war style where you had troops marching towards each other and you shoot them and you hope you get enough. You know, it's a battle of, I mean, I'm going to say this and it's going to also, it's kind of the same thing, but it's a battle of attrition, I guess, in that way, whereas this was a battle of inches in this war. And we get to that a little bit when we talk about the different type of warfare that we were looking at with the Germans versus the French. To go back to Dan Carlin's hardcore history, I actually chuckled while he was going over what the French military looked like at the beginning of World War One. And the reason why I kind of laugh and I reference him is because he really talks about how this is a battle of modern era 21st century military versus 20th century military. And the reason why I say that is because when the French show up for battle, they're wearing these blue outfits, blue coats with, or blue trench coats with red pants, and even like their hats have like red on them. And he mentions how some of the military, like the command, like the lieutenants and the commanders have like the plumes still on their hats. And it's just, so it's very reminiscent of like a Napoleonic type of battle, an 18th century battle. On the other side, you have this military industrial complex of the Germans where they're coming in total 21st century garb. They have, they're rolling up in their artillery with just, it was just a completely different sight to be seen, where you have one battle, two battles of two different armies of different ages, different eras kind of meeting with each other. And I kind of chuckled at that because it just seemed that the French weren't ready for this war, whereas Germany had been and had been amping up their military for so long. With that being said, I think at this point we start talking about the first battle in World War One, and that is the Battle of Liège in Belgium, and that the Germans invaded in that. Now, this has, I mean, we're just going to bring up, I'll bring up some of the numbers on here. As far as like your strength of troops, you had anywhere between 28,000 and 31,000 German troops, 140 big guns. And on the opposite end, you had the Belgians, who had about 32,000 troops, 280 guns. Now, that seems like it would have been kind of a comparable stance against one another. However, there was 6,000 to 20,000 casualties on the Belgian side. The battle itself should have only been 2 days long. That was kind of the estimation of it. And the fact that the Germans were held by the Belgians for a lengthy number of 18 days, and the Belgian resistance kept them at bay, it really kind of helped the French and the British forces kind of get themselves situated so that they were able to, you know, start the offensive or the defensive maneuvers against the German army. So if anything, it was a moral triumph, even though that the loss of the city, Germany eventually captured and the city, and that was, you know, the, again, it was more of a moral victory than an actual victory. But had it not been that, had they not been able to hold them off for that long, like I said, it was supposed to only be 2 days, and ended up being a total of 18 days that they kept that resistance going. The siege itself lasted 11, so there was some period of time there between, but they, for 18 days, the Belgians' resistance in the east had delayed the German operations, which was the advantage, which is what was important. We move on to couple of other important major battles. Like I said, I don't want to go over every battle that we have. I think there are certain ones that need to be kind of talked about, and I may jump all over the place as far as where these battles are taking place and then during the dates in history, because really I just want to kind of give just a brief overview of this. Obviously, the deadliest battle in World War One is the Battle of the Somme, and that took place between July 1st, 1916 and November 18th, 1916. So it was 4 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days, and it took place in the Somme River in France. The results of that, inconclusive. And this is where you start hearing about battle of inches, battle of feet, if that, a battle of meters. It was really, this is the height of the trench warfare. This is really one of the, this was a major battle. And it was really one of these where nothing, there was, like I said, it's an inconclusive victory. As far as the strength of numbers, you had 13 divisions from the British, 11 divisions from the French. It crept up to 50 divisions and 48 divisions. So be that as it will, casualties on the other side, you had starting off with 10.5 from the Germans, moving all the way up to 50 divisions of troops on either side. So I mean, you know, you're looking at just a total massive amount of numbers. casualties and losses in this, 420,000 roughly estimated for the British, and 200,000 estimated for the French. 95,000 killed or missing, 50,000 killed or missing, the rest wounded. The British, the Germans, 440,000, 51,000 men captured by the French, 31,000 men captured by the British. It was just, it's amazing that the amount of battles, the deadliness of this is that it's, and it did nothing. It did absolutely nothing. You know, there was, basically they were able to drive a little bit of a dent into the, they had a little bit of a dent into like the trench warfare, and it just really did nothing. And I find that so funny that, or not funny, I should say, it's funny, sad, but it is. It's just one of these things where the battles of World War One were really just battles of inches, and they weren't really doing much in that, in the Western Front. Another kind of amazing battle, rather, is the Battle of Jutland. And this has to, this is an actual naval victory. And it was the only naval battle between the British and the Germans. And it's, it has, we talk about the battleships and dreadnoughts and cruisers and destroyers and things like this. This is, you know, numbers and strength, 151 combat ships by the British, 99 combat ships by the Germans. Killed for casualties, you had 6,000, almost 6,100 killed by the British, killed of British soldiers, British naval soldiers, 2,500 for German, 674 wounded, three battle cruisers sunk, three armored cruisers sunk, eight destroyers sunk by the, from the British, totaling a total of like 113,000 tons of sunken ships. On the other side, you had one battle cruiser sunk, one dreadnought battleship, four light cruisers, five torpedo boats, 62,000. I mean, this is kind of cool as far as naval battles are concerned, and it took place on the North Sea near Denmark. So again, it was another inconclusive battle just between these two major military offenses. And I mean, again, we're looking at just a massive amount of, what are we doing? What are we doing here? You know, what are we doing? Another major battle is obviously the Battle of Verdun. I think that everybody has heard of the Battle of Verdun at some point or another. Again, this is another Western Front battle. It takes place from February 21st to December 18th. 1916. So this is another massive, long battle of 9 months, 3 weeks, 6 days. It is a French victory. So that's kind of great, you know, wave the flag on there. The French, however, and Verdun is the area in France that this takes place. Again, it's more trench warfare. But in the end, the casualties are mostly even on both sides. The French suffering a little bit more, almost up to 400,000 casualties, and the Germans suffering almost 350,000, over 350,000. So, I mean, you're looking at two different, again, trench warfare, battle of inches, battle of feet, not really much else that's happening here. And in the grand scheme of things, I think if the question has been asked before, like, what would have happened if the Germans had won World War One? And in all honesty, they would have acquired a little bit of land. You know, they would have really only acquired a little bit of land in Germany and a little bit of land in Belgium. And then mostly it would have just been probably lost back to the Belgians and then the French again after some period of time. It wouldn't have been a permanent solution for them. It would not have been a permanent victory for them. That's kind of my take on the Western Front up until the United States gets into the war later on. But I do want to mention a couple of battles that took place on the Eastern Front, as I kind of had talked about earlier. The first battle of the Eastern Front is the Battle of Stolypin, and this is in present-day Russia, Nesterov, Russia. This takes place on August 17th, 1914. Now, before when the declarations of war for Germany and Russia took place, the idea behind Germany was to follow what was known as the Schlieffen Plan. And it's a the plan basically was that they were going to flank through Belgium and into France with a limited force opposing Russia. And the reason that they did this is that they wanted to preemptive strike on France, who they felt was going to try to retaliate for the losses of land in the battle of in Prussia during the war between the Franco-Prussian War which had taken place right before German unification. So the Germans didn't really focus on Russia until thinking that they were going to be able to have a speedy victory over France, and then they could free up troops and come back over to the Eastern Front. With that being said, the Russians did deploy their army and their first army and their second army for the attack. Their combined forces consisted of 208 infantry battalions and over 9 cavalry divisions with 192 squadrons. The first army would attack north of the Missouri Lake, and the second army attacked from the south. So here you go. They're going to kind of flank them. Didn't work out as well as they wanted to. They met the resistance, and it kind of ended up just being really a German victory. It's listed as inconclusive, but it's a German victory. The Germans broke through their Russian division through their flanks. They didn't pursue. The Russians retreated. The Germans didn't pursue Russia, but that's because I think they had bigger things, bigger fish to fry, so to speak. We move to, there's other battles of note as the Battle of Tannenberg, which is also known as the Second Battle of Tannenberg. That, again, is between Russia and Germany, and that's in August, the 23rd through the 30th, so the first month of the war. This was a complete destruction, just near destruction of the Russians' first and second armies by Germany. So this is a straight up German victory. Again, not really doing well. Russia is, and I think people know this from kind of even just a basic understanding of World War One, the Russian Empire goes through a major transition during this period of time, as we know. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that they were not up to par for being, an offensive juggernaut or anything like that. other battles that they had, the Battle of the Missouri Lakes. Again, that's the Missouri Lakes is in East Prussia, present day Russia and Poland. This is another decisive victory for the German army, and in fact, this is where they kick out. Basically, they kick the Russians out of East Prussia and really move them back, further back into Russian territory. It's not the Russian army not really showing that they have the battle wherewithal to stand up with the Germans. There is the Battle of Vistula River, or also known as the Battle of Warsaw. That's a Russian victory. They kind of they come back and they regain lands. This is in mid-September of 1914. They do regain lands in Poland, so they are able to kind of come back and get in a little bit. But I keep saying it. I keep reiterating it. War of attrition. They're really battling for like inches and feet. Not much more than that. And I think that that's something to note, that on both sides, they're just kind of gaining land, some not. It's just they're losing a little, they're gaining a little, they're losing a little, they're gaining a little. One of the battles that I do want to mention is the Battle of Lodz, L-O-D-Z, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And this is near the city of Lodz in Poland. It really is, it's fought like by a greatly outnumbered German 9th Army and the Russians 1st, 2nd, and 5th. And it's during the winter, so it's November 11th through December 6th. This is kind of it's a tactical victory for the Russians, but the Germans' objective was really to prevent them from invading Germany. So it's considered a success, even though they narrowly avoided a disaster. I mean, it's again, it's not even anything that is like a major, major victory. I tend to think that the main difference between World War I and World War II, again, is that the victories, the battle victories in World War II are so much more heroic, so much more major, so much more just milestone victories, whereas a lot of the victories in World War I are just, we outlasted you guys. You know, we're the ones that outlasted you, so that's great. And I feel that that's kind of where we run into a lot on both the Western Front and the Eastern Front in Europe. We move forward now to January of 1917, and a time that, or an incident rather, that's called the Zimmermann Telegram. Now, this was a secret diplomatic communication between the German Foreign Office and Mexico, basically stating that Germany wanted Mexico to attack the United States. And if they were able to attack the United States and keep them occupied, Germany was going to aid Mexico in recovering Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. This is kind of like the spark that ignites the Americans in joining the war. Because at this point, it's important to state that President Woodrow Wilson was keeping the United States out of the war. And in fact, when he ran for re-election, he ran on the whole point of keeping America out of the war. And, you know, that was his whole point. That was the whole, premise of his re-election campaign. Or one of the main premises, rather. The letter, or the telegram, rather, from Zimmermann, and I can read it for you here, because it's actually interesting to hear. "We intend to begin on the 1st of February unrestricted submarine warfare. We shall endeavor, in spite of this, to keep the United States of America neutral. In the event of this not succeeding, we make Mexico a proposal of alliance on the following basis. We make war together, make peace together. Generous financial support and an understanding on our part that Mexico is to reconquer the territory lost in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The settlement in detail is left to you. You will inform the president of the above most secretly as soon as the outbreak of war with the United States is certain, and the suggestion that he should, on his own initiative, invite Japan to immediate adherence and at the same time mediate between Japan and ourselves. Please call the president's attention to the fact that the ruthless employment of our submarines now offers the prospect of compelling England in a few months to make peace. Signed, Zimmermann." The Mexican president, actually, President Carranza assigned a commission to actually assess the feasibility of the Mexican takeover of their former territories. And that would have been crazy if you think of it. I mean, Mexico was in the midst of a civil war, and the president's position was far from secure. The United States had a far stronger military than Mexico, and the German government's promises of generous financial support was very unreliable. And even if by some chance Mexico had the military means to win a conflict against the United States, it would have severe difficulty conquering and pacifying a large English-speaking population, which had long enjoyed self-government and was better supplied with arms than were most other civilian populations. It didn't sound like it didn't sound like a great idea at the time. But this was nonetheless, I think that this is what Wilson went to the Senate, or he went to Congress rather, and he asked for a declaration of war, which was done. And so Mexico, or because of the incident with Mexico and the Zimmermann telegram, that was kind of like the final stick that broke the camel's back kind of thing. April 6, 1917, Congress voted to declare war on Germany. Wilson had asked Congress for a war to end all wars, and that would make the world safe for democracy. Ha ha to that whole end. A war to end all wars. So now that the United States is in the war, the tide turns immediately, I think, in just for that mere fact. you have, it's kind of like a closer coming into a baseball game. You know, you have the guy that's coming in, and, you know, he's going to come in and he's going to close the door and he's going to shut them down. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, from the period of time that the Americans joined to the end of the war was about a year. It wasn't very long that the U.S. was in, was a year and a half, maybe. I think that there is something to be said about the other countries that were affected during this course of time. You had the complete collapse of the Russian Empire during this war. And in fact, during this war is where once the communists took over, or the socialists took over, they pulled out and it was over for them, because they were like, we did it. And, you know, one of the main reasons that there was this whole new idea of, you know, the Russian Revolution itself was because the Russians were tired of fighting in this war. And really, like I said earlier, losing or just maintaining, you know, it wasn't a definitive victory for any of them. I think we also have to make a mention that the Ottoman Empire continued to crumble, as well as the Austria-Hungarian Empire as well. When we kind of come up to the end of the war, I had mentioned earlier that Italy was part of the alliance with Germany and the Austrian-Hungarian government. Italy kind of turned on Germany and sided with the Entente, the Allies, rather. By this point, also, there had been several armistices signed with Bulgaria, the Ottoman Empire, Austria-Hungary. So Germany was the only player left. So November 11th, 1918, the armistice is signed between Germany and the rest of the Entente. This basically ends aggressions of the war. They say that this ends fighting on land, at sea, and in the air. And it starts to begin where we start to come up with the peace treaties for the Treaty of Versailles, which was officially signed on June 28th, 1919. And that is the official ending of the war. Now, I'm going to play a clip for you of what happened, where fighting continued all the way up until 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, with 2,738 men dying on the last day of the war. The thing to note, though, is that this sound is actually, it's actual audio from the end of the war, and you hear the silence that comes, you actually hear birds. And it's just amazing because you hear all this gunfight, all this gun, you know, this warfare going on, and then it's just complete silence. And it's chilling, but it's also so peaceful. And because you could just imagine the horrors that were going on before, you know, the horrors that were going on at 10:58 and 10:59. And then as soon as 11 a.m. happens, boom, it switches. And it's really cool. So I'm going to play that for you now, and then we'll pick up after that. So that was, I mean, wasn't that chilling? It's chilling to me. I mean, it's pretty cool that that's what happened. One of the major quotes I love hearing is, it's actually from French Marshal Ferdinand Foch, F-O-C-H. And he was one of the leaders. He was one of the supreme leaders of the during the Allies. And he said that when he had heard of the signing of the peace treaty at Versailles, he observed with singular accuracy, "This is not peace. It's an armistice for 20 years." And how almost true to the year was he? It was a armistice for 30 years, because again, World War II starts up in 1939. A lot has been said about the Treaty of Versailles. Long story short, the ending of the Treaty of Versailles basically said that Germany was responsible for everything at the end of it. And because there was nobody else really for... There was really nobody else to blame. I mean, there was nobody left to blame. The Ottoman Empire was kind of over. The Austrian-Hungarian Empire was over. Italy had flip-flopped. There was just... Germany was the only country left, and they were the ones that were left to pick up the pieces. They were assigned to, you know, pay reparations for the battles. They were for the war. They were not allowed to build their... They weren't allowed to retain their army. They lost territorial concessions. There were countries, you know, Poland was created. The country of Poland was created in afterwards. And you have just you could see on a map that the difference between the amount of land that they lost based off of that. The years following the war, where we have the, you know, the United States goes through the Great Depression, but also Europe goes through a Great Depression as well. And because of that, there's the beginning of the build towards the new German power, the Third Reich. And a story I heard about a young soldier who was out of work and had gone to the German government looking for an assignment. And they say to him, well, we need you to go to this bar and hang out and listen, because we don't like some of the things we hear coming from this bar. And he goes and he listens and he starts to, you know, really understand what they're saying and starts to kind of agree with what they're saying. And the next thing you know, Adolf Hitler's a full-blown member of the Nazi party. And it just goes to show you that the government that was in between there, the German Empire and then the Nazi party that takes over, is just had no idea how to handle the transition period afterwards. And what Germany ends up doing once the Nazi party takes control is they start to build back up the army. They begin to start everything in secret over again. Not to mention the fact that you have this entire mess happening over in the Russian Empire, where the breakdown of that whole previous government, and now it turns into this communist country, and you have Vladimir Lenin comes to power, and then Joseph Stalin comes to power after that, and you're dealing with this new threat, so to speak, maybe to freedom, if you want, or to Western European ideals. And the whole time happening too, you have just the United States is going through this severe economic depression. I mean, it's the next 20 years between World War I and World War II is another really interesting period of time as well, because you start to see just such a change in just the way Europe is and how it was just a peace for a period of time. It wasn't total peace. It was just a break. It was essentially like they had within the first few years of the war of World War I, on Christmas, the armies would cease operations basically for the night. And you would actually see German troops and French troops and British troops cross over the dead man, you know, the no man's land, and exchange gifts with each other and kind of just, you know, because it wasn't as personal as I think it was later on in World War II. And you just started to see this change in the people where things were different. And I think everybody felt that things were different. So, that's what we have to look forward to at the end of the 1930s and into the 1940s. But with that being said, I think that we can wrap up and kind of look at the end of this and realize that for a war that took a total of, you look at over 5 million dead in military, 4 million civilian, 9 million, over 9 million for the Allies, and over 8 million for the Alliance. You had complete collapses of great empires and royalty ruled empires, and just, I said about the with the historical impact of the Ottoman Empire breaking up, something that, again, some people would have still called themselves Roman citizens. You know, maybe it was, you know, it's kind of like that thing in a Catholic's house, they got a picture of Pope John Paul II hanging up, and they're still hanging on to that. I mean, it's kind of like that, but I mean, still, they may have still considered themselves to be citizens of the great Roman Empire, and that's gone now, and you have just the collapse of the colonial empires in Africa, and just a totally different world at the end before it was. And like I said, to kind of kick this off, is that the war really is a change from the European 19th century style of just imperialism, colonialism, discovery. You know, I mean, if you think back to the early part of the early part of the 1800s, there's still exploration going on, and we still had the slave trade was still in effect. I mean, there's just so many things changed in that 100-year span, and then you have this happen as well, and it really shows that if I was to classify the 19th century as discovery or even just colonialism, I would say I describe the 20th century as war. And that's really where, and this is the kickoff of that. I mean, there were wars beforehand. There were major conflicts that involved multiple countries beforehand, but nothing is a grand scale as this. And at the end of the day, when all said and done, there really wasn't much different in regards to, you still had countries like Austria and Hungary. You know, you had new countries like Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Turkey. You know, the Ottoman Empire, out of that comes Turkey. You have the creation of Poland and things, you know, but in reality, not much else changes, you know, and it's just kind of it's sad that we lost a lot of youth in this world, because, you know, you sent all the young kids to die, you know, young men to die on the front lines. And yeah, so I'm going to get off my soapbox in that case. But so this has been Hail to the Keith. Like I said, this is probably going to be the roughest of all the episodes, just because, like I said, I'm not used to talking to myself, and I really would love some feedback from everybody. Please let me know if you think that this was good, if it was okay, if it was meh. Let me know. You can always reach me at the artist formerly known as Twitter at Flounder824. Reach out to me on Facebook as well. Flounder824 or Keith Langston, you can find me on that. And send me an email, flounder824@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. But this is Keith E. Langston saying, you know, keep history repeats itself. So keep on keeping on. Take care. Bye-bye.